you mentioned those pit stop issues as well. It's interesting that the main kind of person behind that, the proponent of slick, fast pit stops, he's now at the other end of the pit lane sitting on a very different pit wall. The empire's rise and fall, and I think the Red Bull empire's sort of now regressing a little bit.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen and F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. F1 has taken some very interesting turns in the last week, and we don't mean hairpins. We've seen three of the leading drivers admitting that they are a little bit lost. Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton and Lando Norris, leaving the super consistent Oscar Piastri and George Russell to hoover up more points. Meanwhile, the FIA president made his first appearance of the season in Bahrain after a tumultuous week of resignations and accusations. With me to discuss all this and more, we have our F1 writer whose ear is closer to the ground than a sidewinder, Ronald Vording.
Good morning.
And to help us to decode why some top drivers are in need of relationship counselling with their cars, Jake Boxall-Legg. How are you, Jake?
Not too bad, thank you.
So let's start with your moment of the weekend. Ronald, what stood out for you?
Well, besides karting in 35 degrees Celsius, which was very nice from a personal viewpoint, but for everyone going to Bahrain one day, the karting track next to the Bahrain International Circuit is absolutely mega. So if you got a chance, please go and visit it. But apart from that, and surviving the Juvair traffic, which is even more dangerous than karting, the moment of the weekend for me is what happened after the race on Sunday in the paddock, more specifically at Red Bull. I'm sure we'll talk about it in a moment, but to give people some insight on how it goes post-race, usually when I file the report, I go into the paddock, try to find Dr. Helmut Marko to get some quick quotes after the race. Then I go to the pen to talk to Max Verstappen. And after that, it's time for the written media session with Christian Horner. So exactly the same thing now. I went into the paddock, saw Helmut Marko. I said, oh, do you have a minute? And he said, well, things are a bit different now, so maybe later. And that was really telling because 1 minute after that, Helmut Marko, Christian Horner, technical director Pierre Wachet, and chief engineer Paul Monaghan went into the Red Bull hospitality for what looked like a crisis meeting. It went on for like 45 minutes. After that, he came out. I still talked to Helmut Marko, and he said, yeah, today's race has been very alarming and we are very concerned, not only concerned about the Bahrain weekend, but also concerned about Verstappen, his title hopes, and connected to that, concerned about Max's future within the team. So if there's one thing that will stay with me from this weekend, it's what happened after the race in the Red Bull hospitality in the Bahrain paddock.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, we'll definitely come on to talk about that in a moment. Jake, what was your moment of the weekend?
I think from a personal interest perspective, I would probably say Ferrari actually having some updates to bring, really kind of showing that it wants to be involved in that top four battle. It's kind of been at the back of it at the moment so far this season. But new floor did seem to work, but again, there's still a little bit of a way to go with the performance of that car. Also from an on-track perspective, I really enjoyed that Max Verstappen, Pierre Gasly battle towards the end of the race. It's this sort of culmination of all the different strategies. The field had kind of spread by that point. George had kind of postured for the lead, then didn't. And then he had Norris coming back at him, well defended. But to see Gasly in what you would consider a lesser car, keeping Verstappen at bay, that was quite special. It was just unfortunate that it kind of came to an end at the very last minute of the final lap. But yeah, there's some really good battling over the race.
So listener, we're between the Bahrain and Saudi Grand Prix. Piastri won his second race of the season ahead of Russell, with Norris third after a pretty messy weekend and a jump start. Ronald, as you mentioned, you're out there in Bahrain speaking to all the key players. I want to start with Max Verstappen. You touched on it there in your moment of the weekend. He qualified seventh. He finished sixth. He endured a couple of botched pit stops, which is very un-Red Bull. And he reckons that his car is so poor that it isn't fighting for the world championship. It's just taking part in it, to paraphrase him. Meanwhile, you mentioned Helmut Marko earlier on. He actually came out after weekend and he said he's concerned that Verstappen may start looking at other teams for his future if they don't shape up soon. Tell us what you know.
Yeah, well, first of all, the quote about just taking part that came in the Saturday Dutch media session. It's always the case, basically. He's not saying too much in press conferences. He's not saying too much in British media sessions, but the Dutch ones are always quite good. And actually, someone asked him about McLaren, about the dynamic there and Piastri making a big step. And then he said, yeah, I'm not even looking at McLaren because they are not my rivals. I'm just taking part. And then I was the one asking, it means you're not fighting for the championship. And he said, no. And the interesting part is we walked back to the media center and some colleagues even said, like, yeah, he's just 1 point behind Lando in the championship standing. So what is he talking about? But I think Sunday showed the real picture, and it showed that Red Bull has massive problems, not only in high temperatures, but also with tire deck. And the things that Christian Horner told us on Sunday night are even more worrying to me, because he admitted that the issues they face now, the balance issues, are actually similar to last year. And for me, that says a lot about the technical team that has not been able to solve it so far. And even more concerning is that he said, yeah, we still have the correlation issue with the wind tunnel, which is even more concerning because you can introduce updates, but you've got no guarantee they are working. Horner explained, yeah, from now onwards, we will look at the on-track data and that will be leading in car development. But I think all of that, so not being able to fix the issues from last year, still having the correlation issues, they will have a new wind tunnel in 27, but that will also be too late for the new technical regulations. So I think all those factors, and then adding in the new powertrain, Red Bull powertrains, I think so much uncertainty there that I'm pretty sure that the technical team led by Pierre Wachet has to prove Max Verstappen that they can still turn it around if they want to keep him. And that's not only for the 2025 season, but also going into the next set of regulations. So I fully agree with Dr. Helmut Marko at the moment. I also agree with Max that at the moment, he's not really fighting for the title. He's just hanging in there and surviving. And the long-term future of him within Red Bull is very, very much at risk. They will have a large upgrade package at Imola, but that one has to be spot on because at some point the focus has to shift to 26 anyway. So I think Imola will be a key point, absolutely a key point in the season for Red Bull and for Max Verstappen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at, and Ronald mentioned the correlation as well, I was speaking to an aerodynamicist, Jean-Claude Mijot, who famously designed the Tyrrell 019 and various other cars as well. I once spoke to him about wind tunnels because he now designs and develops them as that's his career. And he once said correlation is for people that don't know how to operate a wind tunnel properly, which is a little bit uncharitable of him. But it kind of makes sense that Red Bull is just basically counting down the days until it can enter its new wind tunnel. Correlation issues are obviously, I think, you know, it's quite an old wind tunnel, trying to retrofit it with all sorts of different bits and pieces. But yeah, Red Bull's in this situation now where, and it's kind of unfamiliar to it. We did see it coming towards the end of 2024, where it was no longer able to, it just seemed to kind of run out of ground with development. It seemed to be going in a direction that just wasn't conducive to getting the car in a good place. We saw that drop in performance. The team then thought it had come back and had kind of rectified that. But it just seems this season, the car's all over the shop. The attempts to try and make it a little bit more pliable in the driver's hands haven't paid off. So already had to get rid of one driver because he was so far off the pace. He was the Australian Grand Prix was in Adelaide still. It was just a little bit. It's just a little bit all over the place. And I think you mentioned those pit stop issues as well. It's interesting that the main kind of person behind that, the proponent of slick, fast pit stops, he's now at the other end of the pit lane, sitting on a very different pit wall. The empire's rise and fall, and I think the Red Bull empire sort of now regressing a little bit.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that. I mean, last season we saw the departure of some key Red Bull staff, Adrian Newey, who's now at Aston Martin. You referenced sporting director Jonathan Wheatley there, the sergeant major, really, of the team. He's the one that kind of whipped them into shape. I mean, they did have some mess ups in his time. I remember vividly the Daniel Ricciardo race in Monaco where they didn't have the right tires and that cost him a race victory, but he obviously got it a few years later. But the pit lights not working lost both drivers time and really compounded the misery there. So that you know, you're both very clear that the malaise that was affecting Red Bull in the second half of last year seems to be set in there. So this is now, yes, of course, it's a technical question, but it's also a human question. It's a leadership question, isn't it? This is a very, very stern test for Christian Horner, wouldn't you say, Ronald?
Yeah, and also in that regard, the media sessions afterwards were really telling, because in the pen, I asked Max Verstappen, do you feel that the urgency that you feel about the current Red Bull problems, that the same urgency is shared by everyone in the team? And then Max said, I only speak for myself. I don't want to speak for others. The second one was, do you think Red Bull understands the issues? And he said, you should ask the team. So he was quite clear. Then we went to Christian Horner, and I put the Max quote from Saturday to him. I said, well, Max told us he's just taking part and not fighting for the championship. It was quite telling that Christian said, yeah, we had a bad race. Everything went against us. But you shouldn't forget that he's only 8 points behind Lando in the championship standing. And of course, it's true. But walking away from that session, my feeling was, if there's one race not to downplay the problems and not to talk about being only 8 points behind, it was this one, because everyone back home, they've seen the real picture. And the real picture was that Red Bull was fighting with Alpine and Haas. And yeah, the most telling example for me was that one Haas and one Alpine, Pierre Gasly, they were pulling away. And the other one, Jack Doohan, he was closing a 3 or 4 seconds gap and getting into Max Verstappen his DRS. And with all respect, we're talking about Jack Doohan in an Alpine. So for me, that's not the moment to come out of the race and say, well, we're only 8 points behind Lando. No, this has to be a major reality check for Red Bull. And again, it's kind of surviving until Imola, I feel. And then the Imola upgrade has to be spot on. And if it's not, then it will become a really, really difficult season, which can have implications that go far beyond 2025.
Well, we know how Red Bull treats drivers who aren't performing. So one wonders whether that also counts for people sitting up on the pit wall, because the pressure is certainly building there. So we'll keep our eyes peeled on that one over the next few weeks. Let's just look a little bit further down the pit lane to McLaren. They've obviously won pretty much everything apart from Lewis Hamilton's sprint win in China and Verstappen's dramatic win, of course, in Suzuka, which really was about qualifying as much as anything else. But what's really struck me this season has been Piastri and his consistency. Going into the season, you know, we talked about the prospects for the year and what have you, and I was very, very clear that the key for Piastri that he hadn't had in the past was to find consistency, and that is absolutely what we are seeing from him. But we're seeing a kind of a real confidence about him. I mean, he's not a driver who has swagger, but there is a certain swagger in the way that he is driving that car. And Jake, I'm really curious, because in the queue of these drivers needing some relationship counseling with their cars, you know, Lando Norris is forming an orderly queue there as well, because he's been quite clear that he doesn't sort of feel the connection. And particularly, he says it's the car sort of isn't giving him confidence in the corners, the front end of the car isn't giving him confidence. So how come he's struggling with a car which is clearly going so well? And is there a fix on the horizon that you know of for Lando specifically? Can you fix the car for one driver and not the other?
I think Andrea Stella said it best when he just said that Oscar was just much more adept at being able to shut the noise out of his mind. Lando, by comparison, I imagine there's sort of quite a lot of background noise, a lot of sort of different feelings that he's not able to control. I think when you look at the two drivers, it reminds me a little bit of the McLaren days when you had Hakkinen and Coulthard. Hakkinen was just this sort of kind of taciturn individual that could just sort of seemingly get on with it. Whereas, I don't know, maybe Coulthard was a little bit more at odds with kind of how the team dynamic was, how the team structure was, that kind of thing. What you've got is Norris being in a situation where he knows that he doesn't like the car particularly. He's not able to feel immediately comfortable in it. I think for most drivers, it would be a situation of, I'm not comfortable in this, but I'll try and do my best to get around it. But I think the way Lando's mind works is he thinks he's not going to feel comfortable in it. therefore he's going to struggle in it, and therefore he's going to make a mess in a session. And it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think the only way that you can kind of end that prophecy is A, either, you know, counseling and that kind of thing, and having, I'm sure all teams employ kind of psychologists. Obviously, you know, it's a multi-million pound sport. Why wouldn't they? So a little bit of work there, I think. And secondly, I think there's a few things you can do with setup to make Lando a little bit happier. It might knock a tenth or two off of the ultimate speed of the car, but if he can deliver the extra, you know, if he can deliver the potential, as it were, even with the lower ceiling, then he'll still be in a good place. Ultimately, I think, even though he had a terrible weekend in Bahrain, objectively, he still finished third, which isn't bad at all. And he'll be downbeat and he'll be downcast and he'll be upset and he'll be kicking himself that he messed up qualifying, kicking himself that he false started, all of that sort of thing. But ultimately, he still finished third and he's still leading the championship. It just needs to compartmentalize better and he should be in a better position. It's just he's not been in this position before and he's not able to kind of deal with it in quite the same way that Piastri is.
He's so incredibly open, isn't he? I mean, he talks about, you know, feeling downbeat about things. He blames himself always first. I mean, there's a lot to be to admire there. But on the other hand, I find it slightly concerning. Whereas you'd never really hear Piastri talking like that. He's sort of just a harder personality. He's more forged from the kind of stuff, I guess, a little bit. I don't want to say even like his manager, Mark Webber, because Mark Webber is actually quite a sensitive person, quite a vulnerable person. And he had his moments, you know, when he was driving where you could see that he had a lot of self-doubt and he would be sometimes too open as well. But I think he tried to make himself be harder, make himself more Schumacher, if you want. Whereas actually Piastri has come out of the tin, you know, full Schumacher. That's the way he is. He's it's my way or the highway. He's mentally incredibly strong. He's extremely intelligent. Certainly for me, one of the most intelligent drivers out there on the grid. And that is quite a formidable combination once he finds that level of consistency. Don't you think, Ronald?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, we never doubted Piastri, his mental strength and mentality. But going into the year, we all noticed that it was, in terms of pure speed, there was still, and especially tire management, there was still quite a big difference between him and Lando. And for me, China and this one are clear examples of the huge step that Oscar Piastri has made. In many ways, China and Bahrain have been very similar. In both weekends, Lando has been struggling, in China a bit more with understeer, but still. And Oscar just got on with it, got his first ever Grand Prix pole in China, dominated race, the same here. And for me, that's the most telling, because China is tough on tires, especially the front ones. Bahrain with the aggressive tarmac is especially hard on tires, and especially to come out in those races on top and to dominate them, I think it tells you a lot about the step that Oscar has made. So I think if he can combine those two elements, the mental strength that he always had already in the junior formulas, and the consistency together with his tire management that seems to be on an extremely high level this year, yeah, then I agree with JBL that Lando needs time and it's maybe the first time for him in this situation. But I think looking at the steps Piastri made and his progress, that's extremely worrying for Lando, I would say.
Yeah, you're dead right. It's interesting. If you look at the driver's standings after four rounds, including a sprint race, last year Verstappen was on 77 points and Lando Norris is leading the championship with 77 points at the same stage. But he's got Oscar Piastri breathing down his neck, as you say, 74. So just three behind. And Verstappen is down on 69. Last year, Verstappen's nearest non-teammate challenger, if you want to call it that, was Leclerc, down on 59. So you can already see the McLaren drivers have got a bit of an edge there. And in the team's championship, it's even more stark. At this stage last year, Red Bull were on 141 points, but they had Ferrari not far behind them on 120. And right now it's 151 for McLaren and Mercedes down on 93. So they've got a much more substantial margin in the team's championship. So that's the state of play as we head off to Jeddah. We're going to talk about Jeddah in a moment, but bringing it back to to drivers and their state of mind and that kind of thing. Lewis Hamilton showed a side of himself last year with his kind of maybe I'm not fast anymore. I mean, really beating up on himself. And there was a little bit of that sort of speck of Lewis to be seen after qualifying in Bahrain. But then after the race, he was a lot more perky, felt that he sort of now is beginning to understand the car better. And it's quite interesting because, you know, he is hard on himself, but if you look at it, he's actually, if you include the sprint quali, he's been out-qualified by his teammate Leclerc 3-2 so far, and the average margin between them is a tenth of a second. Now, if you'd said to me back at the beginning of the season that that would be where we stood after four rounds, I would say that that was a fairly optimistic but believable scenario for Hamilton up against Leclerc. I don't know what you guys think. I mean, there's only 7 points between them in the driver's stand. I don't think that's bad at all.
No, it's not. It really isn't, given that he's having to learn an entirely new car. And he has been open about that. He has been open about the difficulties in dealing with new brake material, for example, the power delivery of the Ferrari, using engine braking in corners that he hadn't necessarily had to do in the Mercedes. It's just requiring a very different driving style. And after, what, how long was it Mercedes for? Like, what, 12, 13 years? After all of that time, it is difficult, especially when you're kind of towards the end of your Grand Prix career. It's very, very difficult to get a handle of that. But I think he's acquitted himself really, really well. He's thrown himself into the sort of shark pit, if you like, just tried to kind of ingratiate himself with the team, engross himself in everything that he's needed to learn. And it is a process. You see that with Carlos Sainz at Williams, for example, the kind of difficulty of adapting the other way. But I think ultimately there's room to be optimistic. He has been very downbeat about his qualifying. You cite the sort of 10th difference on average between him and Leclerc. Thing is, in F1 2025 spec, that can mean two or three positions because the field's so tight. So I think, you know, one day he'll get the sort of swing in the other way and he'll out-qualify Leclerc by a tenth, and that'll put him third or fourth, and Leclerc will be ninth or tenth on the grid. So it's such a kind of tiny margin that I don't think he needs to worry. He's just sort of cut from a similar cloth to Lando in that he'll beat himself up and he'll question himself and basically think that his career is over, and a week later he'll go and absolutely smash it. So they're sort of fickle, aren't they, these Formula One drivers?
Absolutely. The other driver who's really impressing me this season is George Russell. And Ronald, you were close to the ground in Bahrain, and coming off another impressive weekend for Russell, there's some talk that he's going to extend his contract, that Mercedes are going to move early. There was a lot of feeling that they would wait and see how things played out at perhaps with Red Bull and Verstappen and potentially, you know, maybe make a move. But it's the jungle drums seem to be that Toto Wolff is thinking of extending his lead driver now. And that, I guess, will only feed the confidence loop for Russell, which seems to be, you know, riding pretty high at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. He has a great start to the season. We're talking about consistency. I think if there's one driver consistent so far, then it's George Russell. So, really impressive so far. I have to say, personally, I'm a little bit more cautious on Russell, his new contract. I do know that Toto is extremely happy with the current drivers. George really growing into the role of team leader. Kimi also impresses me so far, especially if you look back to Formula 2. He was still struggling with tire management a little bit. And then if you look at what he did in Suzuka, I know it was low deck, but still with a massive overcut. And also in Bahrain, he dealt with his tires quite well, in my opinion. So I'm impressed with both Mercedes drivers. But I still would not rule out Max Verstappen for the Mercedes seat. And there's also some kind of financial, economic element behind that, maybe. Because if Mercedes will be by far the dominant team in 2026, then they don't even need to spend an awful lot of money to get like Max Verstappen or whatever top driver, because they will win the races probably anyway. So if you are Verstappen, or if you are his management, if you want to make a move, then from a financial point of view, it might be a smart thing to do it before, because then 2026 is still, at least in theory, it's still unknown. Then you might get a better deal out of it. So unless Mercedes is extremely confident that they don't need Max and that they are impressed enough with the current lineup, that they are confident enough to deal early, which indeed talks are ongoing, I know it. But personally, I think it's not fully set in stone, and I wouldn't rule out Max just yet.
No, I wouldn't either. But it doesn't mean, of course, that it would be Russell that would make way. Potentially, it would be Antonelli. That's the other way of looking at it. But, I mean, for sure, Toto Wolff is definitely holding some cards in his hands. And for sure, there's some different possibilities to see that world working. Of course, the wage bill with a team with Verstappen in it is very different from the wage bill that he currently has at the moment. And that's the calculus. If he does have a dominant car, like in 2014, he absolutely can win a world championship, multiple championships with a Russell-Antonelli combination. And this is what makes Formula One just so intriguing. So shifting gears slightly, every team has now scored points in this year's world championship, unlike previous years when it's been quite deep into the season before some teams at the back of the field have managed to get off the mark. We must mention two midfield teams, I think, at this point, which is Haas and Alpine. Haas, for me, quietly impressive, racking up 20 points, which is exactly the same that they had after four rounds last season. But Alpine was the team under a bit of pressure going into Bahrain. They hadn't scored points. They were the only one yet to get off the mark. But it was a fabulous weekend for them. Pierre Gasly qualified fifth, finished seventh, battling Red Bulls, as you mentioned earlier on. And meanwhile, Jack Doohan also did a pretty good job, qualifying 11th, dropped down to 14th at the flag. But Alpine back in business, would you say, gents?
I think that's fair to say, to be honest. Especially, we were kind of expecting them to pick up from where they left off last year, which was following a kind of very deep into the season development path. New technical lead, David Sanchez, kind of wanted to put his stamp on the car. He thought he'd identified everything that was wrong beyond the excess weight of last year's car. But the team's just been really unlucky at the start of this season. You know, Gasly has been quick, but he's just kind of missed that final little bit needed to get into the top 10. Doohan's been really, really scrappy in the first three races. But it did seem to come together in Bahrain. It's a bit of a reset, that circuit. And Gasly's qualifying result was excellent, moved up to fourth after the Mercedes were given a one place penalty for going out a little bit too early before during the red flag in Q2. And as I said at the top of the show, I was super impressed with Gasly's defense against Verstappen. He was making moves through the race. And again, Doohan actually looked good. And I think this was his sort of most complete weekend in Formula One so far. Obviously, it is a circuit that he knows and he can kind of account for that. But I think Alpine largely got Gasly's strategy right, I would say. Doohan was a little bit unlucky. He'd gone for the kind of undercut strategy at the start of the race, which then short-stinted him in the middle stint, and then he ended up losing a little bit of time during the kind of safety car phase, which probably he didn't need. But ultimately, both drivers did very, very well. The car looks in a little bit of a better state. The team seems to know how to kind of set it up a little bit more. So I would expect in the next few races them to be challenging Haas and Williams a little bit more. Contrary to that, I would say kind of Racing Bulls took a step back. So this midfield battle is shaping up really, really nicely.
And there's one thing, just picking up on Alpine, there's one thing we shouldn't forget. And they are still losing quite a significant amount of time on the straights because Flavio admitted it himself. He said, yeah, with our engine, we're still lacking power. We're still losing time on every single straight line. So if you take that into account, then the actual car is pretty good. And it also tells you something about the turnaround. If we like in 12 months, if you look back at the past 12 months, it says something about the technical team and their ability to turn things around. And if they can do that again towards 26 and they get the Mercedes power unit, then it might actually be a very interesting package. So, taking into account that their power unit is still quite a bit down, I would say. I'm really impressed with Alpine.
Good stuff. All right. Well, off track, there was a fair bit of intrigue going on and has been for the last few weeks. Two kind of major talking points, really, around the first appearance this season of the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Sulayem, in Bahrain. One is the goings-on leading into the weekend with his deputy president resigning and some other broadsides from other people. But let's start with the V10 engine discussion, because you were right in the thick of that, Ronald, when that story broke, that this was something that was in consideration. Ben Sulayem was the one pushing for a discussion on perhaps bringing back the much simpler, cheaper to produce V10 engines that we had back in the day. Unbelievably loud, echoing off the buildings, and everybody needed pelt or headphones, never mind earplugs, to survive with that. I know when I'm in a busy pub or restaurant nowadays, I sometimes struggle to hear what people are saying across the table. And I put that absolutely down to V10 engines and not putting enough ear defense on back in the day. Anyway, that's by the by. There was this push to have this discussion. Some manufacturers were dead against it, understandably Audi coming in and Honda are coming back. Invested a lot in the engines for 2026, the hybrids. Mercedes said they were open-minded going into it. One wonders how open-minded they were, really. They just were certainly saying that. But the point is that they all got together and it was thrown out, really, as an idea, shut down, and reiterated that any engine for the future is definitely going to have a chunky electrical component to it. Ronald, you kind of started this story, so why don't you just give us your take on what went down in Bahrain and what, if anything, we need to pay attention to coming out of it?
Yeah, it's basically all my fault. No, I was in China when we had the session with Nicholas Tombazis, and that's when things got really serious, because of course MBS mentioned it before, but then we went into the Tombazis session, and basically no one knew what to expect. Would it be taking a step further or not, but he definitely did, even mentioning potentially getting rid of the 2026 regulation. And you could argue that maybe this whole process has been the other way around of what you would expect, because the FIA first put it out there and afterwards started talks with the manufacturers. So you can argue if it's the right thing of working or not. I asked it James Allison at Mercedes. He said, yeah, actually, I'm quite happy with it, because now it's at least an open and transparent debate and everyone can make up their mind. But yeah, they had a meeting here in Bahrain. Interestingly, the Honda delegation came over from Japan for a one-day trip. Ola Källenius didn't bother. He just joined via Zoom. But he was also quite outspoken. You mentioned Mercedes. But yeah, when I had a wander through the paddock afterwards, it was pretty clear that at least three manufacturers were like fully against it. Audi, of course, Honda, and also Mercedes. Mercedes mostly connected, I feel, to the confidence they have in their 2026 engine. But yeah, that's basically the first conclusion, that the 2026 regulations will stay. I'm still personally, Andrea Stella told us not to talk too negatively about it, so maybe I should listen to him, but I'm still not fully convinced by the 2026 regulations. But that's also one of the topics being discussed. They are open for some tweaks, but more importantly, they are talking about concessions, because there's still a lot of fear in the paddock that one manufacturer, let's say Mercedes, they get it right, they have a big gap compared to all the others. And then you need some kind of concession system in place to avoid like a 2014 scenario. So that's being discussed. Sources in the paddock told me, yeah, we already discussed this before MBS came up with his V10 plan. So basically discussions are ongoing, no decisions yet, but that's one of the main topics. And the other one is, as you already mentioned, what will be the engine formula long-term? And then we are talking either 2029, if teams agree to shorten and manufacturers to shorten the cycle. Otherwise, it will just be 2031. But that's also a really tricky question. And a lot of different opinions came out of that meeting, because you first have the question, will it be a V10 or a V8? The V8 option was also seriously discussed in the meeting. The second one, will it be with a CUR system or not? And then the third one is, will it be a turbocharged engine or not? Because afterwards I had a chat with Audi and they said, well, first of all, if you go for a V10 with KERS system, that will be way too heavy because you need more fuel. And still, you have the KERS system on top of that. So they don't think that a V10 with KERS system can work. And secondly, they say, well, having an electrical element in the engine formula, that's one thing. But we feel that it has to be a turbo engine because the turbo engines have much more road relevance. And I think not all teams and not all manufacturers agree on it. So basically, as you would expect, the outcome of the meeting is, let's go into another meeting. And the other meetings will be about the concessions for 2026 and the future engine formula, which is still, yeah, a pretty hot topic, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a reason why this has come up and there's a reason why it's gained a bit of traction. Obviously, the traction might be because of people who don't feel they've necessarily got a particularly competitive engine in development for next year. So they would be fanning the flames of this. But for the FIA president to sort of be floating the idea and his top single-seater guy to be propagating it, there's got to be a reason behind that. And it was interesting as well that Carlos Sainz over the weekend was quite open, saying he doesn't really like the look of these 2026 cars. He thinks that his basic implication, Jake, is that F1 is on the wrong track.
I think it's way too hard to say without having seen everything in action. I know that some of these drivers will have driven it in the simulators and that kind of thing, and they'd sort of be sort of like proto versions or beta versions or whatever. It's going to be different for sure because we've got to deal with the active aero situation. Drivers are going to get an overboost function, kind of like we used to have with KERS back in the day. It's just going to be different, and I don't know if it's going to be better or worse. I think there are sort of more fundamental changes that are needed. I think, you know, cars do need to be smaller ultimately. I think the V10 situation has been a little bit of a dead cat on the table that's kind of blown out of proportion a little bit. Also, just as a sidebar to that, that Ronald mentioned that it might not even be V10s. It would be the most Formula One thing ever for it to end up being a return to V8s with KERS like it was, you know, about just over a decade ago. It kind of reminds me of these regulations. It was supposed to be, I think it was supposed to be like a turbo inline four or something like that, and end up being a V6 because Ferrari didn't want, it never developed an I4 engine before and was never planning to. So yeah, it'd be the most F1 thing ever for it to either end up being what we had before or a slightly different version of what we have now. I think, you know, V10s are always a little bit optimistic. It would be fun, but I just, the sustainable fuels angle, and I could talk all day about this, and sorry, I've gone on a little bit of a tangent here. The sustainable fuels angle, it's not this silver bullet that everybody thinks it is. It's like, yeah, sure, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic technology, but it's not this magical sort of non-polluting pixie dust that everybody thinks it is. It takes a lot of energy to create. It's very, very scarce. The kind of sustainable aviation fuel, synthetic fuels sector, the demand far outstrips supply. So it's going to be super difficult to kind of square that off as an environmental kind of study of where the road industry, the automotive industry is going to be in the next few years. But I don't think these regulations will be bad. I mean, maybe we'll get to three races into 2026 and it'll be terrible.
Yeah, my biggest concern is still that it has been done the wrong way around. That's first they came up with the engine regulations basically to keep Honda in the sport and to get Audi in. And then afterwards, they thought, oh, wait, we now need to come up with a car and with an aero package to make it work. And that's when you get into the active aerodynamics. And I'm afraid that it will all get a little bit messy. Interesting points that James Allison said a lot. If it will work or not, a lot on that depends on the push-to-pass. Let's call it push-to-pass system, because he said we don't have DRS anymore. We get the active aerodynamics. And how you replace the DRS system with the kind of push-to-pass, if that works or not, that will be kind of decisive for how well or not the 2026 regulations will work. I still feel that there is concern in the paddock about 2026, maybe more than people talk about on the record. And that's because of the message they want or the message they don't want to send to fans. And that's also a bit of the risk in the whole V10 discussion. The risk is if you talk about V10, if you talk about 2031, the message you send is like, oh yeah, the first couple of years will be bad, but you just need to get through and then the fun stuff will come later. And that's kind of the PR risk in this whole discussion. And that's what F1 tries to avoid. Probably wasn't helpful that the FIA started this discussion in the first place, but I think that's an important element in the background to all of this.
Well, if it was just avid fans that F1 had to deal with, and they've gone through a number of rule changes and put up with all kinds of things that didn't go all that well, but what makes it very different now is how conscious everyone is that this completely new fan base has come to the sport that's, it's younger, much more female, and, you know, has different priorities. And the last thing you want is to make the sport and the racing boring, to diminish the appeal of the drivers and all the rest of it. What this sport needs more than anything else right now is stability, and just let the players play and everybody can enjoy it. So, so much for that behind the scenes action. I mentioned earlier on there was a fair bit going on as well with the deputy president for sport, Robert Reed, resigning, concerned about the direction that the sport is going on, and the UK Federation Chief David Richards as well. I'm sure we'll come back to that in future podcasts and look at whether or not that has any bearing on the presidential election that we're going to have later on this year. But let's wrap up by looking ahead to this weekend, to Jeddah. I'm coming out for this one, really looking forward to it. Always mad to see the F1 cars on those high-speed streets lined with barriers that we have in Jeddah. Last year, it was a dominant 1-2 for Verstappen and Red Bull. Ferrari best of the rest. And interestingly, at McLaren, Piastri outperformed Norris there last year. So, Jake, who do you expect to thrive this weekend, and who's going to struggle?
I think, given the nature of the circuit, so quite a lot of sort of high-speed corners and swift changes in direction, but also it's sort of being a street circuit at the same time, so you've got all the pitfalls of that. In theory, McLaren should, again, be good. That's probably not unexpected. And I would put, if I was a betting man, I would expect to put money on Piastri. But I think, Mercedes should be up there. Ferrari's looking a little bit better. And I guess the fortunes of Red Bull entirely depend on how much confidence they can find in the opening practice sessions. Degradation shouldn't be too bad over the course of the race. I don't think it historically has been at Jeddah because it's a new surface. You're going to get some degree of thermal deg, but not loads, not quite like what it was in Bahrain. So that can sort of equalize it a little bit and give them a little bit more. But ultimately, it's just going to reward who's brave around a lap. It is such a momentum course. It requires you to be in a rhythm and not to deviate from it, because you've got this kind of opening sector. It's kind of like a barrage of corners that are just thrown at you one after the other. And then you've got that kind of cambered, swoopy hairpin kind of bit. And then another barrage of corners that you get to. Somehow the second part of it with DRS. So it's just going to reward anybody that's just brave enough to keep their foot on the throttle, basically.
Well, look forward to that. Ronald, I'm going to see you out there. What are you going to be keeping an eye on? What stories are you going to be keeping an eye out for this weekend?
Well, if I take it back to the very beginning of this podcast and talking about Red Bull, I agree with Jake, but I think they will be better than in Bahrain for two reasons. The first one is less tire deck, as Jake mentioned. But the second one is that Verstappen himself explained that the balance in the very high-speed corners is actually quite okay with the RB21. So I think Jeddah should be better for them, but that's also, again, the risk. Because what shouldn't happen is if they get onto the podium in Jeddah, that people will think, and even people within the team will think, oh, it's not even that bad. It's not a crisis anymore, because that's the big risk. I think Bahrain has showed the real picture. In Suzuka, we didn't see the real picture because you couldn't overtake. I think Jeddah, you won't see the real picture. So I think, Red Bull, the situation is very alarming, but I do expect them to be a little bit better in Jeddah, even though I'm also not a betting guy, but I would also put my money on Oscar Piastri.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we'll wrap it up there. It's the final chance to make your voice heard by completing the Global F1 Fan Survey. You can find the link in the episode description notes. It's closing very soon. And do join our fast-growing Fantasy League community. Check out motorsport.com for details or look on the episode description notes. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllenOnF1 on Twitter/X. My thanks, as always, to Ronald and Jake. You can read all their fantastic news and insights on F1 on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. And my thanks to Dre, Ben and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please share the podcast with all your F1 mad friends today. And we'll be back with another one very soon.